Hello and welcome to the Up North Lowdown. I'm Max Copeland, and it is Climate Solutions Week here at Interlochen Public Radio. So I thought it would be appropriate to bring our Climate Solutions reporter, Izzy Ross, into the studio with me. Hi, Izzy.
Hey, Max.
So what is Climate Solutions Week?
It is a time to focus on what people are doing about climate change. A lot of times climate coverage can feel dire, so this week we're looking at a few things people in northern Michigan are doing about it.
Okay, so things like cutting down on greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah, but even that sounds kind of abstract. Like, there are so many different sources of emissions, and a lot of them we deal with every day, so it can be helpful to talk about concrete examples.
Like driving around in my car.
Exactly. Transportation is a big deal, but food waste emits a lot of planet-warming gases into the atmosphere, too. But don't worry, it's not all depressing. Figuring out how to deal with food waste is also a chance to explore solutions.
So, what are people doing about it?
Well, a little later in the episode, we'll check in on one northern Michigan county that has a pretty ambitious system for dealing with food waste.
But first, Ellie Katz can't catch a break.
A tax break, that is.
Buying an electric vehicle is supposed to be easier and cheaper than ever.
There are lots of new tax credits and incentives, many of which are the result of federal policies created just 2 years ago by the Inflation Reduction Act.
But despite all these new policies, the reality of buying an electric vehicle can often be much more complicated.
IPR's Ellie Katz has the story.
In June 2023, I bought a used plug-in hybrid. It was the first year you could get tax credits for a used electric vehicle, up to $4,000. I pretty obsessively researched this car. I wanted to make sure it met the long list of IRS requirements. In my case, I qualified for a $2,800 rebate. So I filled out some paperwork, the dealer filled out some paperwork, and several months later, I filed my taxes. Then I got a letter.
Got some classic IRS envelope action with my name, my address, my social security number, and then, dear taxpayer.
Maybe you've gotten one of these letters from the IRS before, so you know the feeling.
They have disallowed all or part of the credits claimed. In my case, it's all $2,807 I claimed for this used hybrid EV I bought last year. So now I'm gonna write a letter to dispute this, see if I can get my money.
This tax credit was the reason I bought the car. It made it cheaper than buying another similar used car. So I went to an online forum for EVs, and I saw I wasn't the only one having this problem.
Unfortunately, this was certainly not the only case, but this was not, as far as I know, a super common case.
This is Albert Gore. He is with the Zero Emission Transportation Association, an organization that pushes for EV adoption. And he says me and others have had a tough time getting this credit, likely because of the newness of the program.
2023 was really the first year of this credit.
And that whole year, nothing was really formalized or streamlined. When I bought my car, the dealership hadn't even heard of the credit. The IRS had no official forms or reporting software. I just had to submit certain information to the IRS and hope that the dealership did the same. But that's not the case anymore. In early 2024, the IRS rolled out a point-of-sale rebate program. That program allows the dealer to give you the credit right there on the spot.
And not something that is dependent on, you know, a dealer's word or an IRS process later or the following calendar year, but something that is taken off the price of the vehicle right there at the dealership.
But pretty much everyone who bought a used EV in 2023 missed out on that point of sale program. Ann Blair is with the Electrification Coalition, another nonprofit that works on EV adoption.
Excited that you were an early adopter, but caught up a little bit in the newness of this industry.
Blair says, I likely fell through a very narrow gap between when a policy like this is passed and when it's actually implemented.
I think in some ways we have to expect a few of these issues, but I know it can be very, very frustrating for consumers as we evolve into this new transportation electrification future.
But that doesn't necessarily mean I won't get my tax credit. If it turns out the dealership didn't submit the paperwork, I could try and file a business complaint. Plus, I'm still waiting to hear back from the IRS on my dispute letter. EV technology might be the future, but when it comes to getting a brand new federal tax credit, well, snail mail is still alive and well.
IPR's Ellie Katz reporting.
But Max, cars are just one part of the transportation sector.
That's true. And the whole thing could use some greening up. But where are you going with this?
Okay, so say you want to take your electric car to Wisconsin.
Okay.
You could drive there, but that takes a while. So you decide you're going to take a car ferry.
Oh, I know where you're going with this. You're talking about the SS Badger, the car ferry that takes passengers across Lake Michigan.
That's right. And I actually talked to someone who basically did that. Kelly House is an environment reporter with Bridge, Michigan. She went on an EV road trip and she made a pit stop at the Badger.
Why?
She wanted to check it out because the Badger's new owners are thinking about getting the ship off coal.
About 2 years ago, the SS Badger was purchased by a new company, Interlake Maritime Services. They're a company in Ohio that has multiple ships. Most of them are like freighter type, you know, diesel powered. They bought the Badger, and I think they just quickly realized, you know, it's not going to look good if we continue owning this coal-fired ferry when we're talking about decarbonizing the rest of our fleet. You know, their sustainability manager told me, it is hard to talk about your decarbonization wins when you have, quote, the elephant in the room being this coal-fired ship. It's the only coal-fired steamship in the entire nation. And it's a problem, of course, if our government is talking about, you know, shifting toward renewable, the days are probably numbered for this ship one way or the other. It really is a stark 180 from the previous ownership that basically refused. There were decades of battles between the previous owners and environmental groups over the air pollution from the coal burning and also over water pollution, because for most of this ship's history, the coal ash was just dumped directly into Lake Michigan. But there also is a lot of money right now to explore decarbonization. And part of the reason that this project is able to happen on the Badger is because they got a federal grant to help pay for the study.
What would a renewable or clean energy SS Badger look like? How would that even work?
That's a great question. No one has an answer yet, but it could look like battery, potentially. That's really hard to imagine right now as the sole source of energy for a giant 400 some foot, you know, steel vessel. But because it's a ferry, it has the advantage that it has a limited route and it docks in the same spot every night. I imagine in my mind a giant EV car charger that's, you know, ship sized. That's one option. One option is using like diesel or some of the fuels that we're already really familiar with for ships, but having a carbon capture system on board.
Does it say anything about the bigger push for renewables in Great Lakes shipping and in other maritime activities?
I think in some ways it's like a moonshot. You know, if you can do the Badger, certainly you must you must be able to do, you know, the ships that are on diesel. Some people are excited about getting ambitious here, even though in our day-to-day we have a lot of debates politically about whether or not green energy is the future. Also interesting to me is the fact that this is being done willingly by a company that is not being required to do it. I think that says something about where industry sees things heading, you know, regardless of who becomes president or how energy policy looks a year or two from now. This is going to be a more difficult transition. It may take longer. You know, some of the technologies that they're exploring aren't really feasible today, but they're hoping maybe in a couple of years they will be.
Did you hear anything about from people who were on the ship about what this could mean for them, you know, and mean for their jobs or their relationship with Great Lakes Shipping?
It was a real mixed bag from workers. You know, part of the thing about a coal-fired steamship is that it is not automated. It requires more workers than modern ships do. And there's a real camaraderie around that. There's a real pride about sort of being part of maintaining this history. So there was definitely some sense of sadness among some workers, But also the sense that, you know, some of the folks I talked to sort of were like, if this is what can ensure that the Badger keeps running into the future, that's their ultimate goal. And they're sort of willing to accept potentially a loss or change of some of the jobs on that ship if it means that the ship itself continues to exist.
That was Kelly House of Bridge, Michigan. You can find a link to her work at our website, iprnews.org.
It's time for a break. When we get back...
What would you describe that smell as? Compost smell? Garbage smell?
I don't smell anything, Izzy.
Compost as a climate solution. More on that when we return.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
For more than 20 years, Nick Tyson has spent his days on his hands and knees in the dirt. Farming. It's a tough way to make a living.
I call this whole project labor of mixed emotions. It's not a labor of love. Sometimes it is a labor of absolute disgust. I cannot stand it. It is so hard and I feel so downtrodden. Other times I'm just floating through the beauty and the luck of it all. Like, this is just, how is this happening?
Next time on Points North, a story about working really, really hard for years and not knowing if you're going to make it until something big changes. That episode of Points North is available now. You can listen to it wherever you're hearing this podcast.
And we're back.
I'm Izzy.
I'm Max.
And this is The Lowdown. Max, what do you know about composting?
Oh, lots. We used to have a compost bin in my backyard when I was a kid. We would just throw all our organic food waste, all our kitchen scraps in a big pile in the backyard, and eventually it all turned to dirt.
Okay, so that's one way to do it. That's also what my parents do. But it can be a little bit more sophisticated than that.
What do you mean?
Well, even in a backyard compost pile, you can actually control a lot of different factors, like the smell and how fast it decomposes.
No way! That's wild!
Yeah, and when you compost food scraps instead of throwing them in landfills, it can really cut down on emissions.
Wow. So what does that mean for us?
Well, Michigan wants to cut food waste in half by 2030.
Okay. Sounds ambitious.
It really is. And they've been trying to get more communities to do that by, cutting down on what's going to landfills. There's a whole hierarchy of food waste solutions that starts with preventing it in the first place, and it goes on from there to feeding people, feeding animals, etc.
Okay. So where does composting fit in?
Well, it's a piece of the puzzle. It's kind of far down on the food waste solution ladder, but again, it can help cut down emissions, and people need to do something with organic waste.
Sure. And from what I've heard, there's a pretty big player right here in northern Michigan, right?
That is correct. Emmett County started its own composting operation years ago, and now it's considered kind of the gold standard among local programs in Michigan.
All right, I'm pumped. Let's go dig up some black gold.
Compost, that is.
Right.
It's around 9 a.m. at the Emmett County Waste Transfer Station. Lindsay Walker is standing at three bins full of food scraps. They're for people to drop off household food waste.
You have landed at the Emmett County Drop-Off Center, and we are so much more than a dump.
Walker works with Emmett County Recycling.
Our biggest mission and objective here at Emmett County Recycling is to find opportunities to recover what are very much resources and prevent them from going to landfill.
One thing they're good at keeping out of the landfill is food waste. That's because they compost it. They collect it from restaurants, and they have sites for people to drop off scraps. People can also drop off yard waste, and that's all mixed together in big compost heaps.
So these are called windrows, and what you're seeing are the oldest piles here first. These piles...
The state has set high goals for reducing food waste, and it's requiring counties to get on board. Michigan law already bans yard waste from landfills, so some counties compost that, but composting food is still pretty new. That's not the case in Emmett County, where state officials say they're nailing it. Emmett began composting food scraps in 2015 and has processed over 4 million pounds. Experts say its model works because it operates like a business and is supported by policy. Walker says they encourage composting and recycling by making it more expensive to throw things away. They call it the pay-as-you-throw system. And they sell compost by the bag, bucket, and truck bed full.
This is something that we can all get behind, and you have to just implement it with a vision and policy and get the buy-in for more diversion opportunities.
They can do this because almost everything has to run through their transfer station, whether it's compost, trash, or recycling. Erin Hyday, an organics waste expert with the state, says having real models like Emmett County show what's possible.
They're very important because, there are a lot of communities that just say, oh, we can't do it. You know, there's this mindset of, oh, we just can't be done. Well, no, it can. Emmett County has proven that. And it might take some, blood, sweat, tears, and money, but it can be done.
He says what sets Emmett apart from many other local governments is that they invest directly in recycling and composting.
They don't just look at it as, oh, well, we have to do this and put the bare minimum in because we're just taking a waste. They say, no, this is actually, we need to run this facility well, because we run it like a business, and we get all the knowledge that we need and have the skilled labor, have the right equipment. If we do this correctly, this can actually be a benefit for us, not a, financial drain.
Hyday says Emmett's program is possible partly because they have a small population in a rural area. Other places might need to contract with outside businesses.
So I can just dump the fish waste in here, and I can pick through and pull out the plastic contamination.
And even in Emmett County, Lindsay Walker says they still have a ways to go.
Even though we're recovering about, 10-15% of the food waste from what's going in the municipal solid waste stream, it still is like a drop in the bucket about how much food waste is going to landfill here.
Walker says a big step would be to do curbside pickup, but state regulations mean they can't afford to expand too much. And a lot of food scraps can be handled at home.
We don't want to be the only composter in Emmett County. We want to spread that compost love around so that we are recovering more materials and we realize that we're limited.
It's beautiful.
It is beautiful stuff.
Looking at the dark, rich, finished compost at the waste station, Walker gets excited again.
You can feel it, Izzy. It's like very, it's cool. It's not hot, very moist, and it looks like healthy soil.
For IPR News, I'm Izzy Ross.
What would you describe that smell as? Compost smell? Garbage smell?
I don't smell anything, Izzy.
I learned so much, and I had such a good time doing it.
Okay, that's great. I'm glad you feel that way, because we're actually going to learn a little bit more, so prepare yourself. Brace yourself, Max.
I'm braced.
There's this big election coming up in just a few weeks, really.
Okay, I think I've heard about this one. You're talking about the November presidential election between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris, yeah?
Okay, so I'm actually not talking about that election. Oh. I'm actually talking about some of the races a little closer to home.
Oh, sure, like all the local and statewide candidates and issues that will also be on the ballot.
Yeah, exactly. So from now until Election Day, we'll be airing a weekly segment that we're calling the Election Notebook. Here's IPR's Claire Keenan Kurgan and Michael Livingston talking about that.
So Claire, I hear Michigan got some attention for its I Voted stickers this year. I hear it's something straight out of Twilight.
Yes, we did get some attention on the national news last week for our I Voted stickers. There was a contest, and kids of all ages and some adults submitted sticker designs. The elementary and middle school winner was a sticker that has a werewolf ripping its shirt off in front of an American flag. So you can see why that got some attention.
Totally rad.
And so Jane Hynes told the New York Times that she didn't want to do something that you usually think of when you think of Michigan. Why not make a wolf pulling his shirt off?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. So what else is going on this week?
This week, we're starting to see some candidates for the state house races coming together for forums. So in Manistee on September 12th, The candidates for the 102nd district are going to meet for a forum run by their Chamber of Commerce. This is Kurt Vanderwall versus Kathy Pellerin Mahoney. Vanderwall won by 60% in 2022, but this is a new Democratic challenger. And there's also going to be candidates for the city council and the county commission there. Then later on this month, on September 23rd, there's the first forum for Betsy Cafia and Lisa Trombley. This is the pretty tight race for the 103rd State House District.
So September 12th for the folks in Manistee and September 23rd for those in Grand Traverse region. But what happened to that Senate debate in Traverse City?
That is a good question. So the Record Eagle reported last week that that debate was not as certain as people thought originally. And it turns out that it's actually pretty hard to get any of these Senate debates locked down in Michigan. The candidates have not really coordinated which ones they're committing to. It seems like there will be a debate in Grand Rapids, not too far away, but the one in Traverse City, neither candidate has committed to yet.
Anything else we should be keeping track of? We got these debates and forums, but what else?
Yeah, there's some interesting debate going on in Harbor Springs over a new zoning law, and that is going to be on their ballot in November. The city council announced that last week. So this has to do with housing and lots of other zoning questions in Harbor Springs. In the new law that was passed in May, they expanded ADUs and duplexes and also included provisions for shoreline protection, among many other things. Some people weren't so happy with this new zoning law, and they organized a petition, which we can all do when we don't like a law that our city's passed. You can organize a petition to challenge it. Mm-hmm. And although there were some issues procedurally with that petition, the city decided that they're going to put it on the ballot anyways. So people in Harbor Springs will have a chance to vote on these zoning questions. And that's something that the Petoskey News Review has been reporting on lately.
Claire, thanks for being here and giving all these important updates.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was IPR's Claire Keenan-Kurgan and Michael Livingston with our new weekly segment, The Election Notebook.
And that's it for the Up North Lowdown today.
We had contributions from Ellie Katz, Michael Livingston, Claire Keenan-Kurgan, and me, Izzy Ross.
Our editors this week were Dan Wanchura and Peter Payette. I'm Max Copeland.
And before we go, James Earl Jones died this week at 93. He was the voice of characters like Darth Vader and Mufasa.
Jones was born in Mississippi, but spent much of his youth in Michigan.
He attended school in Manistee, where he got his very first acting role in Shakespeare's Othello.
Now, we don't have any recordings from that original school production.
But years later, at the height of his career, he portrayed Othello on stage in Minneapolis, and it was recorded for PBS.
So today, we leave you with the iconic voice of the iconic actor, James Earl Jones.
Perdition catch my soul, but I do love thee, and when I love thee not, chaos is come again.
I find it very necessary to come back to the stage, because not only are you stretching yourself from role to role, but you're stretching yourself from night to night, trying to keep the experience fresh and alive for each new audience.
The voice of the actor, James Earl Jones.
Hey, Izzy, thanks for joining me this week.
Thank you so much for having me, Max.
And thank you for listening. That was fun. I had a good time.
I'm so glad. I also had a good time, but it was a lot of work.
Yeah, it was a lot of work.